Hi, I'm Bill Corcoran Jr., and I'm your host for the On the Stacks podcast. Today, I'm chatting with Nick Duvall, owner of Duvall Leatherwork. What's up, podcast? Episode 22. Welcome to the On the Stacks podcast. Nick, how are you today?
Good. How are you, Bill?
I'm good. Thanks for coming in. By the way, I have to ask, because one of my coworkers before you got here, we were talking about it, and I don't even know if I actually know the correct pronunciation of your last name. I say Duvall.
It is Duvall. Okay. It's not Duval. It's,
oh, good. All right.
It's Duval.
Because that was the debate.
So sometimes Duval will be the single L version of Duval.
Okay.
So my lineage goes to 1650 is when my first ancestor arrived in America.
Okay.
And then through that person, I am related to Robert Duval, the actor. So that's where that lineage comes from. And then the Duval part is a little bit different than the Duval.
Okay, because, you know, prior to you showing up, he was telling me about some actor or actress. I think it was an actress, and I think he was saying her last name is Duval. I could be totally wrong.
There could be, and some people pronounce it differently. So, yeah. But it is, I mean, it's Duval.
Duval. So I won the bet.
You won.
Thank God.
Good job.
And I did not pay Nick to say that, you know, that we're pronouncing his name incorrectly or incorrectly. So I'm glad we got that out of the way, but but, you know, let's talk a little bit about your history. So you're not from NEPA.
No, I'm not. And first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me here today.
Yeah, of course.
It was, you know, kind of an honor. I know the show and I know a few things about it. And when you asked me to do it, I was like, sure, why not? I mean,
yeah.
I think that any kind of, you know, learning who people are, what they do, why they do it is an interesting facet of life. And I personally am interested in other people's stories, and thanks for having me.
It's, yeah, absolutely.
So to answer your question, I am not originally from northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I moved to Wilkes-Barre when I was 19 years old. That would have been 1999. I moved here. I went to college at Penn State Wilkes-Barre. Land surveying was my major. I had taken forestry in the Penn State system, and I liked land surveying, and so I changed majors, and this is the only place that they teach it in all the Penn State system.
So you went to the Penn State campus where you're from?
Yeah, at Mon Alto. Yes, Mon Alto is a forestry academy. That's Penn State's forestry program, and in forestry we had land surveying, and again, I liked it, and so that's why I came here too.
So did you have to transfer here to finish the degree? Is that why you actually came to this area?
Yes.
Yep. Interesting.
So that's the only, you know, what's one of the majors that they really, that they focus on and teach there is land surveying.
Okay.
And so I graduated from school and got a job in the engineering world, land surveyor, worked at it 4 years. I hated my job. It wasn't for me. I've always been a creative person. I've always worked with leather and done the things that I do now. And at the ripe age of 25, I just straight quit my job, started my business in the basement of my house, January 1st, 2005. And that was 15 or 16 years ago by now.
So, you know, how did it start as a kid? I think, you know, I've read a little bit about you that you've always kind of been doing this type of work with leather.
When I was a child, my father had some leatherworking tools. In the 60s and 70s, it was popular for people to tool leather and make kits and little trinkety things and homemade bags and stuff like that. Kind of hippie stuff, you know, like that was just a popular thing to do. So he gave me some of his tools, and it wasn't anything that I'm running a business off of. I mean, these are literally hobbyist tools. And so at the ripe age of, like, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I had a huge interest in just, like, anything to do with the outdoors, the woods, Indians, everything that kids, you know, love to do. I don't know about kids today, but,
yeah,
you know, when we were kids,
at least back then,
that was, like, everything, man. Like, the cap guns and, like, everything cool then was what I was into. And so, you know, I used to just make little trinkety things and everything. It just looked stupid. And it was like a hobby of mine. There was also a leather tannery in the town where I grew up too, Mercersburg, Pennsylvania. I actually grew up outside of town. We were about 5 miles out into the country. And there was a leather tannery in the town. And they operated until, I think, like the mid-90s, I think. So once in a while, I would have some access to, like, pieces of leather. you know, my father would know somebody that worked there and, you know, this and that. And so once in a while I would get some leather, and then I would save up my money and buy something. And it was like back in the day, we used to look in a catalog and like call it in and like order it. And and it just kept progressing and progressing. And then I went to school. And while I was in school, you know, I've always had an interest, again, in history and things of that nature. And I had a friend of mine whose father was a saddler, and we used to work with leather and different applications versus just hobby. And my original intent of my business was military reproductions. So for about the first 10 years of my business, I would say, maybe just a little bit less, I focused exclusively on 19th century military equipment. So the buyers of this would be military, living history interpretation stuff, museums, and some level reenactors as well, too. The museum system nowadays is more focused on really high-end reproductions versus real artifacts. So if you go into a museum and you see George Washington sitting on a horse, and he has his entire military uniform on, and he has maybe a sword and some other pieces and parts and pieces that go with it, it's all reproduction. Nothing of it is real. Well, someone has to make that stuff.
Sure.
Someone has to do the research. Someone has to understand how it's made, the old, the techniques, the this, the that. And I was one of those people. Like, I focused on examining artifacts all the time. I mean, wow. I have my library of artifact research just in leather goods manufactured for military use from early 1800s up until about the Indian Wars, 1870s, is like, there are very few people who know more about that stuff than myself. Just the gear, not the uniforms. I mean, the guns obviously go with it, but sure, there's a lot of parts and pieces that go with a moving soldier. And I've been in private collections, government collections, I mean, all kinds of places to examine artifacts to be reproduced to the, I mean, number of stitches by hand sewn in individual panels and pieces of how things go together. Very, very, very complex, detailed stuff.
Wow.
So I have my business, and started in the basement of my house, as I said before. I worked there for about approximately maybe a year. And I bought our building, our shop in Kingston, and started my business. And that's exactly when the financial crisis, 2007 and 8, hit. And looking back on it now, compared to coronavirus, you know, scares, I think that was much worse. People were very frightened about like just having their homes foreclosed on, and like the stock market was out of control. Gasoline was like $4 a gallon. I mean, like, it was very much more out of control than it is now. Like, this is a virus. No one can see it. Like, they hear people get sick. I don't know anybody sick. You know, it's a very little bit different. You had a paid staycation for, you know, 2.5 months. Bonuses. Really? Yeah. I mean, and so the 2007 and 8 were not like that at all. I mean, it was much, much more dismal. And so I'm making obsolete military equipment to a very select group of buyers through some of the worst economic times in, you know, modern history that we can remember. And so it was very challenging to run my business and just be like, you know, keep it going, keep it going, keep it going. And got into about like 2010, 11, that I had was starting to have had enough of that kind of work. Everybody with whatever they do comes to a point where they just get tired of it. And I just got tired of that kind of work. You know, I got tired of government contracts that were just like, you know, they never spent the money until it was the last minute. So it was feast or famine. And it was just a lot of work. I mean, making products like how they were made in the mid-19th century, this is before sewing machines were barely even invented. I mean, everything is sewn by hand. Every detail is hand sewn, period. Like, you can't even cheat that.
Yeah.
So it's a ton of work. And I just got tired of it. And so my cousin who lived in Texas at the time, Arizona and Texas, he was like, you should see some of these websites. It's like, you know, these hipsters are selling this and they're selling that. And they're like, just selling these belts for like $200. I'm like, I could make that drunk. Literally. I mean, it's so basic. I'm like, you know, like, this is laughable.
Yeah.
That they're commanding a price like this for something that basic. So I really just got the gears in my brain thinking. I'm just like, you know, why not like start to make some modern products? So I did, and you know, it was still a little bit dismal in the beginning, and I still kept up with my historic stuff, and we went a little bit further and further and further. And I was starting to get a line of products, you know, mostly men's things, belts, wallets. And we sold in our Kingston store and on our website. I mean, I've had a website for as long as I've been in business. And it got to the point where I just did not need to do historic work anymore. And I decided to 100% quit a whole product line. So, you know, it would be like if you guys printed and all of a sudden you're like, that's it, we're making Gatorade. I mean, it's, you're still making something. You still got to print the label. You still got to do a couple little things, but we're going to do something completely different. And my customers were very, you know, slightly disappointed, but it was for the best. And so we just started making more stuff, designing more things. I really got into doing art festivals, show after show after show, town after town. I mean, it was like I was on tour going through these freaking towns and just this next place and the next place. And it allowed us the cash flow and the movement of products and stuff that we just couldn't seem to get traction in Kingston with. And then maybe a year or so later, I started to really focus on developing my purses and handbags. And that took off like crazy. I mean, and it got to the next level and the next level and the next level. And now a major part of my day is design work. What the next bag's going to be. What are the hot colors for this fall? You know, I went from being somebody who made, you know, obsolete military equipment to fashion, essentially.
Yeah.
And it allows me to be so much more creative than when I used to do military gear. Because military gear, you go to a museum, you look at it, you copy it exactly. It
had to be done to spec.
It's exactly what it has to be. Make the pattern. You know, it has to be the right type. It has to be linen thread. It has to be particular type tanned leather. Like every detail is just like, it's very hard to find this stuff because it's obsolete. They don't make it anymore, period. Bags, wallets. I mean, it's like I had free reign. It's like I was born again. Like my whole product line was just waiting to go.
That's crazy. You know, I've known you for a number of years now, and I had no idea that that's how you started.
Yeah.
Honestly.
So let's talk about the fact that what happened in that time period. You know, it's such a bizarre product line to get into. But what it did is it made my technique amazing. Like I can my technique and craftsmanship, which most people will never experience because I'm just not going to do it again. I don't need to. But like when I see really poorly sewn products or like
things
that
know.
Are like handmade, I'm like, that is so
not.
It's just thrown together, and my technique is the way it is because I learned from people that's their only technique was a particular way. Mid-19th century leather working techniques. Now, it doesn't convey to bags and it doesn't convey to a wallet. But what it does do is it says, you know, hey, when you look at these stitches, there's a particular distance that they are off of the edge. And it's not too far and it's not too close. It's just like it's a nice look. And those are the things that when you look at old stuff, anything, it could be an old printing press or old, like, a car. They did things just slightly differently than we do today.
More attention to detail.
Exactly. And so when you can convey that little bit of detail into a tangerine-colored handbag, which
we
has
talk about
nothing
that.
Like a Civil War cartridge box, it just adds that little bit more detail.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's talk about these bags you brought in. I mean, like, I didn't know what to call that color, but clearly it's called tangerine.
Tangerine and turquoise.
And turquoise, okay. Yeah. Well, so, by the way, I'm going to have to hide these photos and everything about this podcast from my wife.
Yeah.
Because she loves that color.
I'm husband's worst nightmare when it comes to spending money on
Yeah. bags. Yeah, this was a poor decision on my part having you in. We're going to have to cut this episode. I'm kidding, of course, but no, so you know, tell me about these two bags. You know, you got the tangerine and the turquoise. Like, how and why did you come up with these colors, these patterns? Like, yep. how did this happen?
So we have to go back to the original designing aspect.
And the smell too, by the way, is absolutely amazing. I know everyone listening right now can't smell them, but everyone is subconsciously smelling leather as we're saying this, because this podcast studio right now just literally smells like pure leather. It's amazing.
No one has ever walked into my store and said that it smells disgusting.
How could
they? It's always just like, even the mailman, like every day, he's like, God, he's like, this is my favorite stop of the day.
That's probably his favorite place to go.
Yep. It really does have an intoxicating smell. For sure. That people absolutely love.
Yeah. So tell me about the colors.
So we got to go back to the beginning. So when I started making anything, it's always blacks and browns. You know, black wallets, brown wallets, everything's, you know, the colors. So last year, I decided that I was going to start really releasing some bright, colorful leathers. You know, they make the stuff all the time. It's always available to me. I just need to go through my color swatches that Tannery sent me and look and see what I can find. So I came up with a handbag line that we call the Boucriere. The Boucriere is French for beautiful leather. So this is our Boucriere line. The Boucriere line changes every season. So this is our spring and summer bag. We have it in three colors and three different styles. So I chose these two colors because they just are super flashy, super summer, and they just look amazing. You know, it's hard to believe sometimes when you see this stuff that it's made right in your hometown.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this bag is as nice as something you'd go buy at any department store anywhere in the world.
Absolutely.
And quite frankly, I work on enough Louis Vuitton bags that even on some of the levels of that stuff, it's like, these bags are far superior to that. It's just that I don't spend, you know, $4 or $5 billion on marketing and suing fake knockoffs all the things that come along with it.
So do these colors come this way?
Like, yes.
Okay.
Yep. So all leather comes into our shop as either sides, full hides, or pieces somehow of what it is. I buy it based on the color from either brokers or the tanneries. Brokers are people that deal usually in South American leathers. They come from mostly South America because some reason you just can't directly buy from there unless you're buying huge amounts. So these kind of things come from there. But then our wallet leather, we deal with tanneries. Our belts, we buy right from the tannery. So this leather comes to us whatever color I decide that we don't have to have a custom color. It's just swatches of stuff that they already manufacture and produce. It takes about 10 and a half hours to make one of these bags.
Wow.
Just one. So
who
it's a tremendous.
You?
Myself, I do work still on making things.
Okay.
And then I have six employees, so, wow. So they're in levels of all different kinds of stages.
Skill.
And skill levels. But I typically oversee most like heavy duty production like that.
Okay.
Other stuff we make that, you know, I've already designed it. I've already figured out all the details of how it is and I let them roll with it on a daily basis.
Wow, that's incredible. It really is.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it shows in your passion for it. I mean, it obviously shows in the quality of the work, and it's just really, really, really cool.
Thank you very much. We do a good job, and it's a unique thing, and we're very proud to make our products right in Kingston, Pennsylvania.
So just real quick, just run through the handful of products that you offer.
We make men's wallets, ladies' wallets, men's belts. Duffel bag, or not duffel bags, but like a gym bag size, messenger bags, handbags, tote bags, all kinds of stuff in between, little knickknacks, novelty. I mean, we even sell hats that have leather patches on them that we, you know, come from production of something else. But our main product that we produce are wallets, men's wallets and handbags. I mean, those are just huge sellers for us.
Yeah. And I read this quote, I think, on your website. It says, if you're looking for a belt, take your time. Pick the right one. This might be the last belt you ever buy.
Could be, because it lasts so long.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the things. I mean, we make them, it's durable. It's meant to be, the quality of the product comes first, and then the price tag. So I make it to the best possible specs that I can, and then it's priced. Well, most of the world is not done like that. It's made based on how cheap it can be made, and then it's manufactured. So, you know, I go backwards a little bit. And again, that's what happens. You get a belt that you're going to get sick of before you wear it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, clearly, you know, the life span of your products are much longer than most.
Absolutely. And you're buying a piece of our time, too. I mean, when you buy that handbag, you know, you're buying 10 and a half hours of my life or someone's life that made that. I mean, I've never thought once about this t-shirt. Someone in Bangladesh sat in a factory and made this all day, and I've never thought about that. But when I break it down to you and say, that took me 10 and a half hours of my life to sit there and make that so that you can carry it on your arm. That's a little bit different, right?
Yeah,
it's a little profound that it's like, oh, that's pretty cool, actually, you know?
Yeah.
So you're really owning a piece of a craftsman, but also an artist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild. I think most people, and including myself, I mean, I don't think I ever would have guessed that. I mean, I knew, you know, it took a considerable amount of time, but
yeah, lots of time. I mean, just think about every little stitch around each one of those raindrops you know, it's done on a sewing machine, but it's still, you mess one up, you know, it's the whole piece of leather screwed up. It's, you know, back to game one. You have to be a really strong sewer to work on stuff like that.
Wow. Interesting. So your products, you guys sell on your website.
Yep.
You guys also have the store on Wyoming Ave in Kingston.
Yep.
And you also do like wholesale work?
We do not. We used to do quite a bit of that kind of stuff. Last year it got to it wasn't a bad thing. It was just we had to rein in what we do. And, you know, I just had to bring it all together into our own store to bring people in so that we could function on a better level. Less accounting, less trying to figure out what's selling in one place or another and this and that. The website has been a good seller for us. It's actually kind of picked up a little bit, and I've been doing a tremendous amount of SEO work on it myself. But the store is still, believe it or not, in Kingston, Pennsylvania. I mean, people stop in and shop. Even during pandemic, I mean,
have you been open the whole time? Were you able?
No, we closed from March 19th, I think was our last day. And then we reopened June 1st.
Okay.
I mean, there was a little bit of web traffic, but it was so minor. It wasn't even.
So you do more retail walk-ins.
Yeah.
Than web.
Yeah. And we also do repair work too. So we repair all kinds of bags and
things
of that nature. But it's just a nice little robust business. There's nothing like it around. You know, I couldn't
even name another store.
It's super unique. I mean, in today's world of stuff, everything's, I mean, if you're not unique, you're just, you're really just an Amazon product at that point. That's just like, how cheap can I get it? You know, like,
it's a race to zero.
Yeah. Race to the bottom. It's always the, and I'm not in that world. I mean, that's not what I do. You're getting something that's a little bit different than the, you know, the typical rat race things you buy online.
Yeah. Wow.
But I have to compete with. Yeah. Selling online too. I mean, that's a very challenging world to.
Yeah. How so?
To sell in, you know, every time you're trying to get first page, second page, third, even sixth page, Google listings.
Yeah.
You know, it's impossible. You can't fight with the Macy's and Cabela's and things like that of the world.
Sure.
And so you try your best to put the right stuff into the website that needs to be there, and you know it does work.
Yeah. How about social media? Is that does that work for you guys?
It does. You know what social media does is it creates desire. You know, I don't sell straight up. No one just buys a bag off Facebook. They look at it 100 times, and then their husbands find out about it, and then it's Christmas, birthday or Mother's Day, and then boom. And then they get it, and then they want the matching. I mean, it's a desire thing. It's just like, why do we have to have a nice car? Mm-hmm. You know, guys are the same way. A watch or a gun or like whatever men.
Yeah, sure.
Handbags, though, are very, very desired, especially something that's unique.
Yeah.
I mean, and then you start getting with it's a Duval bag, and I mean, you just can't go. Anybody can go to the mall and buy a bag. That's next level,
mm-hmm.
you know. And yeah. they're the beginning of the bell curve kind of people too. You know, they're the people that are like, because it's a new thing and it's like it's not quite trendy yet. And so that's my whole angle of stuff is that it's super unique. It's super limited too. You can only get them seasonally. And
so how do you decide on these things? Like where do you get like inspiration for, new bags, new designs, things like that?
First of all,
now that you're in the fashion world,
I know, right? Obsolete military equipment to fashion.
Yeah.
Color wise, I typically use, simple, like palette tone colors of the season, like what they're predicting is going to be hot. So I'll use that as a baseline for anything that's maybe coming out. I'll definitely use a few, fashion blogs that I read. I don't hold that stuff too. I don't think those are normal people. Those are not Northeastern Pennsylvania people, but there are some details sometimes that are cool that you can incorporate into things. And other times too, is I just get away from work. Like I just get away from all of it. And I've come up with some like fantastic ideas, just not being in the mix all the time, just hiking or
just everyday life.
Yeah. Shooting or cooking or, I mean, even just meditating, doing nothing. Like I really just bring it together sometimes.
Yeah.
But you can't be working. You can't be constantly on the grind, I try to come up with ideas.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
No,
absolutely
yeah.
impossible.
No, I agree. And, a lot of my ridiculous ideas or good ideas, could just same thing, kind of just come about like whenever, like yep. on the fly, least expected.
Yep.
And
pandemic was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I had 2.5 months of just like silence
thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I worked in my shop. I fixed this. I reinvented that. We reinstalled this whole new inventory system. It's like, it's my genius invention of the year is this stupid inventory system that no one else in the world would care about at all. But for me, it's just like seamless and anyone can do it. And now I don't have to. So that allows me to think about my bags a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's what happened with a lot of people, a lot of businesses and a lot of business owners during the shutdown is a lot of people, were able to really work on their business a little bit more and
absolutely
fine tune things, make things better. And
absolutely.
So you got the inventory system.
That was, one of 600 projects that I, I'm a small business owner. I always got a thousand things going on.
Always something.
I have to allow myself to have the freedom to not be at work. And it's not because I'm being lazy and don't want to work. It is because I have to think. And thinking is a hell of a job. Most people don't.
Yeah.
And it shows when you walk around usually. I mean, you
totally.
Can... So thinking is, it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure you go through the same thing. There's times when you're really in-depth in thought in something and you're just drained.
Yeah.
It's like you poured concrete all day, but you didn't do anything except just think.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So being, you've been here for a number of years, obviously. What was it, 19?
20 years. 20, it was pushing years. 21 years here pretty soon. Yeah.
So, what is it about this area that you like? You moved here, you stayed here. What's your favorite thing about NEPA?
Favorite thing about Northeastern Pennsylvania. I genuinely like how I can get enough city vibe that I don't have to be in Lower Manhattan to get that vibe. And then I can also drive, 30 minutes outside of here and be in some super remote game lands or anywhere in Pennsylvania, forest. And then be right back to it and not have to, be concerned if I'm going to run out of gas before I find a gas station. It's 600 miles in one direction or blah, blah, blah. So, my number one favorite thing, I'm going to have to say my wife, because she's from this area. So there you go. Yeah.
So you met her here?
Yeah, met her here. And that's why, I wouldn't say it's why, but this is a great place to conduct business. Yeah, I wouldn't have half of what I had if I was in a major metropolitan area. For starters, I would never even be able to afford the building that I bought, period.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, second of all, there's a workforce that is perfect for what I do. You know, it's just light scale manufacturing, industrial sewing. You know, there's not a core group of industrial sewing, but if you find the right person, you can mold them into being a industrial sewer, which is something no one does industrial sewing. I mean, that's like, but everything you have on was sewn in a factory by someone at a sewing machine. So there's plenty of opportunity for hiring and expanding and just running a business. We have all the right infrastructure. Now the pandemic stuff, I mean, it's the internet will crash this winter from online holiday sales.
Yeah.
I'm making the prediction right now. I mean, it's ridiculous to make a statement like that. But it's going to be so epic this year that it's perfect. It's low cost of operations, and you box it up, you make it here, you box it up, and you ship it to somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't have to worry about water supply issues, and you know, my whole entire workforce has to make like $100,000 a year to pay off their 16 years of college, and then they aren't going into that field. And you know, when I traveled quite a bit in the past 5 years with, you know, doing shows and things like that, so I've been all over the place as far as like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, like all those kind of places. And you know, you go into some really nice towns and cities. I don't think that I could afford to operate my business in a place like that. So, you know, other than my wife being a part of like why I really like this area, it really is nice for my business, period.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
yeah.
I'm sure you probably see some benefits in that as well, too, and
for sure.
Operating a business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, we're able to be much more competitive, you know, than, like you said, than, yeah, how could you afford a building like this?
Go to Houston, Texas, and try to buy this building.
Forget it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you'd be bankrupt before you even start.
Yeah.
You know, so it is nice that we have these, you know, areas that we can function.
Yeah. And you used to live right down the road a long time ago from the studio.
Yeah.
When you first moved here.
Yeah, when I first moved here, it was North Washington Street.
Was there a story to this? Before we started, we were talking about...
Well, I used to drive by here all the time, and this was kind of a dumpy building. And
yeah, before...
I remember you guys all painted it up nice and did the stucco work, and I was like, oh. And I, back then, I had no... What would I ever have printed in my life? I didn't even know what.
Yeah.
I was just a dumb hick from the woods. So, but yeah, there was that aspect. I remember the brewery too. Like when I first moved here, like there was like a smell. You'd smell like, I guess they were probably like cooking the mash or something like that. And they used to do it at nighttime because it always had like a bready smell to it.
Yep.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I smell it from time to time, like in the mornings coming in.
Yeah.
You know?
That was always super cool. And it was just my first experience living in a city, you know? Like, most people think this place is like, oh, it's not a city. Well, it's like, well, let me tell you what. Where I'm from is, like, nowhere. I mean, and this is a city, period.
Yeah.
And it might not be, you know, Austin or Houston or something like that, but it's definitely, you know, it's enough of a city for me, at least, to get my city vibe from.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. No, I'm glad you enjoyed here, and... I think you have an awesome business and a really cool story. And like I said, the first half of the story, I did not know.
Yeah, it's pretty deep. And the other detail that you don't know probably about me is that I was the lead singer of a band for 10 years too.
Okay.
And that was a big part of why I stayed here as well too. So we were in a touring band, a heavy metal band.
I did not know.
Yeah. And that was a major part of my whole time frame. So it was like... early 2000s, talking about, like, you know, we would often play with Breaking Benjamin, and Lifer was a big band that was around during that time, and we were like the next band behind that, kind of, but much more heavy. And you know, 10 years of that, and it gave me all kinds of confidence to run my business. And you know,
what did you learn from that?
Well, I was the lead singer, and so the ability to literally have no stage fright, and doesn't matter if it's in front of 12 people or 5,000 people, it's just get it done. You know what I mean? Being that confidence to like, to lead a group of people, to make music and to play in front of other people, and, have, interaction with those people. I mean, our the last or second to last album, we charted top 200 Billboard albums for 2 weeks. So, I mean, that means nothing today. Absolutely nothing. But that's pretty impressive for some, you know, for podunk kids from, you know, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and a heavy metal band to do something like that.
Definitely. So what gave you the confidence? Was it just...
I have no idea. It just clicked.
Okay.
It just clicked.
Experience? Really? You just...
Once I, like, you know, I had been in several other bands throughout my career to that point. And all the guys that were in the band with me were in several bands and things of that nature. And once we clicked as people and started making music, dude, it's just awesome. I mean, it's like making the greatest business deal you ever... I mean, every time you play. Don't get me wrong. You know, there'd be shitty nights that you'd play places and you're just like, ugh. But then there's other times where it's like, you know, you get super awesome opportunities to open up for some, you know, rather big name band, and you're going to play in front of a couple thousand people that night. I mean, that stuff is like, that's legit, you know, and you're traveling and you're doing this and that. I mean, we released, I don't know, 4 albums maybe. And, you know, even to see the stuff on iTunes to this day is like, that's kind of cool, you know, but I was finished. When we were done, I was finished, period. I boxed it up, put it on a shelf. I only talk about it once in a while. It's not like I'm embarrassed by it or anything. It's just, it's just done.
Sure.
You know,
piece of history.
Yeah, just like even making historic stuff. It's a piece of history. It's over. Like, people ask me to make stuff, I'm like, no.
Yeah, and here I was, like, before the podcast started, I'm telling you, like, how to use this mic properly, and you're probably thinking, like, this dumbass has no idea.
It's okay.
Like, I was, like, I've
been in front of a microphone for a long, long time.
Yeah. No, but, like, I didn't know that part of your life, you know? And it's just kind of funny, you know? So, obviously, you've been in front of a mic before, so.
Many, many times. Yeah. And photography, too, like, just. Yeah. Tons and tons of photography.
That's really cool.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a part of my life that, you know, I'm glad I did it. I don't think that it's even a thing you could do anymore. I don't think that live music is even a fraction of what it is. And even when we were playing, you know, you could just tell that the whole vibe of that stuff is just coming to an end. You know, music is a very odd way to make money. I don't know how anyone does, quite frankly. Yeah. You know, and I'm glad that I'm done with it. I mean, I couldn't imagine being a touring artist and have to, like,
right now,
what are we going to do? Like, that's how I make my money, and it's coronavirus. And even if they say it is safe to go to a concert, I'm not going to a concert. I mean, you know, talk about just asking to get possibly infected with something.
Yeah, so, you just don't know.
Exactly. You don't know. And if that's how you make money for a living, that's got to be very...
It's a little scary.
...challenging. On top of the fact, too, that anyone can download your stuff. On top of the fact that you have an attention span for music of one song, if even that. And, you know, the creativity level is... It's just over. It's just a medium that's like... You can only beat a dead horse to death so long. And
yeah.
You know, but so that's my
other
part of my life of... to get me to this chair right now.
Yeah. So tangerine and turquoise bags.
Yeah.
And of course the brown too. The brown is very nice. Not that I'm knocking the brown. I love the brown.
That bag is badass, man. And when you carry it, you're even more of a badass. Cause like, and I have a black version of it too. I have both personally.
I like the brown.
I like the brown too. I use the black as my shooting bag. It has all of my stuff when I go to the range in it. And that's pretty badass too. So in its own right. But yeah, when you travel with a bag like that,
it's pretty legit.
You mean a business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's no JanSport backpack.
No. No, it is not. It definitely is not.
So
it's not your Adidas duffel bag from the 90s.
And when you wear a suit or you wear nice clothes and people travel and I see them with a backpack, I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You're wearing a suit and a backpack? I mean, to each their own, but.
Yeah. And hey, JanSports were a thing, I guess, at one point. I think they still kind of are.
Yeah, I think they really are. And the LL Bean bag, too. Remember that was?
Yes.
That was like super popular. I always wanted one then.
Yeah.
Never happened in my world.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll go home tonight and buy one for myself.
There you go.
Put bricks or something in it and carry it around.
All right. Well, I think that about does it. Nick Duval, not Duval.
Yes, Duval. Yeah. Nick Duval.
Yeah, Nick Duval. DuvalLeatherwork.com and retail storefront in Wyoming Avenue, Kingston. Nick, thank you for joining me on the On the Stacks podcast today.
Thank you, Bill, for having me. And everyone have a good night.
If you'd like to learn more about the On the Stacks podcast, be sure to search the hashtag On the Stacks on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. We'll catch you next time on the Stacks.